We are in the last little bit of Deuteronomy 16 and 17. Okay, so, oh man, where was the break? Deuteronomy 14, verse 22 through Deuteronomy 16, verse 17 was all about Sabbath. Remember, all the specific laws all relate back to one of the Ten Commandments, and they're in order, okay? So Deuteronomy 16, verse 18, all the way through the end of chapter 18. So 16, 18 through 18, 22, which is the end of chapter 18, are going to be command 5, okay? Which, does anyone remember what that is? Honor your father and mother. Now, once we've gotten past the first four, it's going to get a little more complicated, because if you remember, the first four also relate down to the last six. Do we remember that? Okay, when we did the 10, I wrote the 10 commandments out, right? So do we remember command 5, which commands it relates back to of the first four? They're also in order.
The first one, love the Lord your God.
Yes, it's the first two. So honor your father and mother relates back to no other gods and no idols, okay? So that is God. God is supreme. He is the supreme authority. He is creator God. There's only one God. You can't have any other gods, no idols, no nothing, right? Then on a human level, we have human authority. And the basic human authority, the smallest level, is that of parents, okay? That is the smallest unit. Honor your father and mother. So the authority that parents have is supposed to represent the authority that God has over all creation. Okay? So in 16, 18 through chapter 18, we're going to see elements of human authority, right? But also elements of no other gods and no idols. Okay? And no other gods and no idols were expounded in chapters 12 and 13. So there are going to be some parallels and some repetition, okay? Because this section is going to be the practical outworking of honoring your father and mother, how it works out. And it's going to be a visible demonstration to the world of no other gods and no idols, okay? So God has established human authority to project and establish divine authority, right? So you obey your parents. We talked about this when we talked about command 5 way back however many weeks ago that was. Okay, you honor your parents because if you can't even honor and obey your parents, who will you not be able to ever obey? God. If you can't even respect and honor the closest authority to you, right, you're never going to be able to obey God. Because by obeying your parents, that is obeying God, because God has said that. Okay? Okay. So we're going to run into four types of authorities in these chapters. Okay? 2.5 chapters. Okay, we're going to deal with first judges, then the king, priests, and then prophet. And who fulfills ultimately all four of these? Jesus, right? We often talk of Jesus as prophet, priest, and king, but he's not just prophet, priest, and king. He's also judge. And we know that, right? Because in the end, he's going to judge. But a lot of times we just talk about him as prophet, priest, and king. But he is also judge. So Jesus is obviously going to be the perfect fulfillment of all of this, but it's going to be four: judges, king, priest, prophet. Okay? Now, the structure of this section is a key, it's a double, well, it's two chiasms. Does anyone remember what a chiasm is? Yes, so the top and the bottom match, and then the emphasis is what's in the middle. So first, we're going to talk about judges. Okay? And this is chapter 16, verse 18 to 20. Okay? Then we're going to get the nature of righteousness, which if you just read this and you don't understand the chiasm, it's kind of like, Moses, you go off on a tangent. Like, I don't understand what the connection is, okay? Because he's talking about judges, and then all of a sudden he's talking about Asherah poles and idolatry. You know, and so you're like, what's the connection? Okay, so this is going to be 1621 to 1713. Okay? Then we're going to get the king. Instructions on the king. And this is 1714 to 20. So this is your first chiasm. So where's the emphasis? Which is? No, what's the middle of this?
Righteousness.
So the point of this chiasm is the judges and the king are supposed to make the nation righteous. This is their job. The judge isn't, right? Because a judge, right, is supposed to make right rulings to make sure that people are doing the right thing. And who's going to even be over the judges? It's going to be the king. And so the king's law and how he rules is going to impact the judges, which then impact the people. And their job, per Deuteronomy, is to help the people be righteous. Okay? Then the second chiasm, we have priests. Okay, we are not going to get here today. We're going to, I don't even know if we'll get through this up here, but 18:1 to 8. Then we have the nature of worship. This is 18:9 to 14. And then we have the prophet. And this is where Moses says there's coming a prophet that will be like me. Okay? And this is 18:15 to 22. So, in the middle, we have worship. What's the priest's and the prophet job? To make sure that the people's act of worship is correct, that they do it the right way. I mean, you had to have the priests, right? Especially the high priest, to go into the Holy of Holies once a year to atone for the nation's sin. And the prophet receives word from God, okay? Which then would inform how the priests do their job if it's something different. Okay, this is very horizontal in nature, and this is very vertical, right? Judges and king, they're dealing with people. The priest and the prophet, they're dealing with the people's relationship with God, right? The priests are offering sacrifices, making sure you're doing it right the way. The prophet is telling the people, this is the word of God. Act this way. Okay? We have some parallels between this. Judges, here, this is plural, right? There are going to be many judges. Priests, this is plural. But when you read the section, king, now there are going to be multiple kings, right? But when it talks about the king, he is singular. Okay? And when Moses says there is a coming, a prophet like me, it is also singular. Okay, so you're going to need a lot of judges because they're going to need to be in every little town and city, right? But you're only ever going to have one king that rules over them all at a time. Well, I mean, Israel blew it multiple levels, but this is the goal. You need many priests, right? And their job is never done because they're sacrificing from sunrise to sundown and then they got to do it all again tomorrow. So you need a lot of them, but you only need one prophet who comes and declares the word of the Lord. Okay? One other parallel between these two chiasms is in, and it just, the verses aren't inspired, right? Like the verse numberings aren't inspired, and so this is just coincidence. But in 1715, it says that the king has to be one of our countrymen, Israel's countrymen. Okay? And in 1815, the prophet has to be one of the countrymen. And we'll talk about the significance of that. But if you really look at the structure, there are a lot of parallels between these two sets of chiasms. Okay? But again, judges and king are focused on the righteousness of the people. The priest and the prophet are focused on the worship of the people. Okay? The king and judges are to point us back to Yahweh by establishing righteousness. And we're going to use justice and righteousness a lot today. Okay? The prophet and the priests, because they're focused on worship, they're really going to help Israel obey commands 1 and 2, right? No other gods. If you're going to have proper worship, you're going to only have one God worshipped in one place, right? And no, obviously idolatry is not going to be a part of that because that's what God has commanded, okay? Also, one more thing with the priest and the prophet. Priests, they're going up to God, right? They're offering sacrifices up to God. They are making requests of God. They are interceding between the people and God, right? That is their job. The priest's job is to stand in the middle between the people and God. Prophet, they only receive from God. God talks them. They don't get to decide when God talks to them. They don't get to decide what God reveals to them, okay? They are just the mouthpiece of God, right? When God decides to reveal something, he comes to a prophet and he says, you tell the people this. That prophet doesn't get a choice. They don't get to ask God questions, right? They just receive from God. So the priests go from man to God and the prophets go from God to man. Does that make sense? Okay. Let's see if I... Okay, any questions on any of that? The priests go up. Okay, so the priests go up to God. The prophet comes down from God. Right? Because the priests, they can take the requests of the people. They're offering sacrifices up to God. They can go to God and ask questions, right? And then by means of the Urim and the Thummim, which we don't exactly know how that works, God does give them an answer. Okay, but God is also not speaking to priests like he is to prophets either. Okay, so priests can take their requests and make them known to God. Not that prophets can't pray, okay? But the prophet's main job is whatever God has told him, he has to tell the people, right? And he doesn't get to pick when God tells him that. He doesn't get to ask God questions about it. He just, God says it, and he has to go and tell the people. Because before written scripture, right? I mean, obviously, as you move through the Old Testament, you get more and more written scripture. But the prophet is the word of God. And what the prophet said is then written down and becomes scripture. Okay, but this is how God revealed new revelation or what he wanted his people to know specifically at that point in time was through a prophet. Okay, any other questions?
Did there have to be a priest in every single city that told about God?
That's a good question. The priests did live throughout Israel, but they would only serve in the temple in Jerusalem because God said you can only worship in the temple in Jerusalem. To Israel, back in Israel, so we don't operate under the same structure. Any other questions? Okay, so we're going to go through our passage in the chiasm section. So can someone read for me just chapter 16, verses 18 to 20?
You shall not be partial, and you shall not take a bribe, for a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and perverts the words of the righteous. Justice and only justice you shall pursue, that you may live and possess the land which the Lord your God is giving you.
Okay, so the judges, it says you shall appoint judges and officers. So the judges would be the ones making judicial decisions. You know, you have a case. There's a dispute, whatever, you bring it before the judge, they make a decision. The officers would then kind of be like the police or whatever, the executive branch, whatever. They have to carry out the decision or enforce that whatever the decision is, it gets done. Okay, so you're going to have multiple of these in every town, all throughout Israel. Every town's going to have at least one, if not possibly more, okay, judges to make these decisions. And it says, you shall appoint for yourself judges and officers in all your towns. That word towns is literally gates. Okay, and if you remember in the Old Testament, it was at the city gate where judgments were made. If you remember Lot, when he chooses to live in the fertile plain near Sodom and Gomorrah, and you can see his progress closer and closer. First, he just picks the plain, then he picks up his tent, and then he moves next to the city, right? And by the time the angels come for him, where is he? He's in the city gate, right? Which we said possibly he has now become even an elder, a ruler, a judge of some sort in that city because he is sitting in the gate. Okay. If in the story of Ruth, when Boaz goes to make Ruth his wife, right? But he says there's a kinsman redeemer closer than me, right? He brings everybody to the city gate. The kinsman, the closer kinsman redeemer, and the elders of the city, they all gather at the gate. You know, and he says, "Do you want to buy the land? Oh, if you buy the land, you get Ruth." Oh, no thanks. Okay. And then Boaz says, "Okay, I'll do it." Okay. But that's all at the gate. Because legal decisions like this, this is where it was done, in the city gate. Okay. Then he says, "They shall judge the people with righteous judgment." Okay. These words are very important. And if you pay attention throughout your Bible, you will see this righteousness and justice or judgment, those two terms combined together all throughout the prophets, okay? Because this was the purpose of the judges, and it's going to be the purpose of the king, okay? Righteous judgment should remind us, all the way back in chapter 1 of Deuteronomy, chapter 1, verse 16, if you can remember that far back, it says, "Then I charged your judges at the time, saying, hear the cases between your fellow countrymen and judge righteously." When we talked about this verse in chapter 1, we said that judge righteously, right, means that your judgment establishes righteousness. What you decide brings forth righteousness in the people you are deciding amongst. Okay? So this, and if you remember, in chapter 1, this whole thing about judges seems a little odd placed, right? But this is the point. The point of the judges in Israel was to make the nation righteous, right? Which is something obviously they can't do, okay? But that was their job, okay? Here in chapter 16, you are to judge the people with righteous judgment. So righteousness is an intrinsic quality of the judgment. So not only is your judgment, the decision you make, right and good and true, it is supposed to also produce right and good and true actions in the people themselves. Okay, so they are to have righteous judgment, and it is supposed to produce righteousness in the people. Okay? Which, obviously, if you think about that, you're like, nah, a man can't do that, right? A man can't make somebody else righteous, which is the whole point. Verse 19, "You shall not distort justice. You shall not be partial. You shall not take a bribe, for a bribe blinds the eye of the wise and perverts the words of the righteous." Okay? So if righteousness is an intrinsic quality of your judgment, then of course you're not going to take a bribe, or of course you're not going to be partial. You're not going to have favorites, right? Because those things aren't righteous. They're not good and right and true. Okay? So it's kind of like, if you're really going to have righteous judgment, then obviously you can't take a bribe, and obviously you can't be partial either to the rich or the poor or your friend or whatever it is. Okay? You are supposed to reflect God's character. Okay? And if you flip back chapter 10, verse 17 of Deuteronomy, it says, "For the Lord your God is the God of gods and the Lord of lords, the great, the mighty, and the awesome God, who does not show partiality nor take a bribe." Okay? So God is, of course, absolutely righteous. He has no favorites. He doesn't take a bribe. The judges, they're to mirror God's character. So if they're going to have righteous judgments, then obviously they can't be partial. They can't take a bribe. And if they do, they are now misrepresenting God, because their whole position as judge is to mirror God's judgment, to mirror God's character. So now if I'm a corrupt judge, outsiders could look at you and be like, that's what your God is like. You know, your God is swayed and your God has favorites, you know. So that's what the judges were to be. So if they were partial and did take a bribe, they would misrepresent the character of God. Verse 20, it says, "Justice and only justice you shall pursue." That word justice in the Greek can also be translated righteousness. So I think Brittany has the LSB. In the LSB it says, "Righteousness, righteousness you shall pursue." Okay? And it's tying in then the righteous judgment, right? And this is the goal. The goal is that all of Israel would be righteousness. would be righteous. And the point of the judges is to help promote and establish that righteousness amongst the people. Talk about an impossible job. Okay. Righteousness is the standard of God that is totally correct, and justice brings us into conformity with that standard. Okay. True justice is always righteous. Right? You cannot have true justice that is unrighteous. True justice brings about the truth and what is right and what is good. Okay. Okay, so the point of the judges is they are to pursue and establish righteousness. They need to be righteous in their judgment, and they are trying to help the people become righteous themselves. Okay. Questions?
Well, we can see where we're all messed up nowadays.
Well, Israel also didn't do such a great job of this either. Right.
And it's like right here. You shall not distort justice. Yeah, we've done a great job with that.
And that's the problem is when you have justice, like justice is just kind of what facilitates
righteousness.
Right. But when you don't have righteousness as the standard,
right,
then your justice isn't truly
justice
because it's not the standard of righteousness,
right,
which is why we're where we are.
Right. Who reads Deuteronomy? Even in the church, who studies Deuteronomy? Right, Joyce? It does. It does. That's right.
But then again, like we've said from the beginning of Deuteronomy, you could have these laws on the courtroom, which most a lot do, you know, or have in the past. Mm-hmm. You can have the laws. But if you have that without the heart honoring God, then
it's meaningless anyway.
It doesn't do anything.
Yep.
It doesn't work.
Anything else? All right. Can someone read for me 16:21 to chapter 17, verse 13? 16:21 to 17:13.
You shall not plant for yourself an Asherah or any kind of tree beside the altar of the Lord your God, which you shall make for yourself. You shall not set up for yourself a sacred pillar, which the Lord your God hates. You shall not sacrifice to the Lord your God an ox or a sheep which has a blemish or any defect, for that is a detestable thing to the Lord your God. If there is found in your midst in any of your towns, which the Lord your God has given you, a man or a woman who does what is evil in the sight of the Lord your God by transgressing his covenant and has gone and served other gods and worshipped them or the sun or the moon or any of the heavenly host, which I have not commanded, and if it is told you and you have heard of it, then you shall inquire thoroughly. Behold, if it is true and a thing certain that this detestable thing has been done in Israel, then you shall bring out that man or that woman who has done this evil deed to your gates, that is, the man or the woman, and you shall stone them to death. On the evidence of two witnesses or three witnesses, he who is to die shall be put to death. He shall not be put to death on the evidence of one witness. The hand of the witness shall be first against him to put him to death, and afterward the hand of all the people. So you shall purge the evil from your midst. If any case is too difficult for you to decide between one kind of homicide or another, between one kind of lawsuit or another, and between one kind of assault or another, being cases of dispute in the courts, then you shall arise and go up to the place which the Lord your God chooses. So you shall come to the Levitical priest or the judge who is in office in those days, and you shall inquire of them, and they will declare to you the verdict in the case. You shall not do according to the terms of the verdict which they declare to you from that place which the Lord chooses, and you shall be careful to observe according to all that they teach you, according to the terms of the law which they teach you, and according to the verdict which they tell you. You shall do. You shall not turn aside from the word which they declare to you, to the right or to the left. The man who acts presumptuously by not listening to the priest who stands there to serve the Lord your God, nor to the judge, that man shall die,
Thus you shall purge the evil from Israel. Then all the people will hear and be afraid and will not act presumptuously again.
Okay, so this section is the nature of righteousness, right? So verse 20, righteousness, righteousness you shall pursue. How do you do that? Verse 21 through chapter 17, verse 13, okay? So first, easy, don't set up an Asherah pole, okay? It's an idol. Asherah was the female consort, I believe, to Baal, and she was the fertility goddess. And so associated with her were all type of fertility rites and prostitution and whatever. And if you did whatever, then she would help send the rain. Baal sent the rain too, but she was the fertility goddess. So an Asherah pole was, I don't know, something that represented her. So what it means, what it's saying is no idolatry. Okay, or false form of worship. Now, if you remember, chapter 7, verse 5 of Deuteronomy says, but thus you shall do to them. This is when they enter the land. You shall tear down their altars, smash their sacred pillars, and hew down their Asherim. So that's Asherim is just plural of Asherah poles. Okay, and burn their graven images with fire. So, chapter 7, verse 5, Israel is commanded, when you go in the land, you tear all this stuff down. Destroy everything. Then, yep, the idols. Then again, in chapter 12, right, verses 2 to 3, it says, you shall utterly destroy all the places where the nations whom you shall dispossess serve their gods, on the high mountains, on the hills, and under every green tree. You shall tear down their altars, smash their sacred pillars, burn their Asherim, again, with fire. You shall cut down their engraved images of their gods and obliterate their name from that place, okay? So again, chapter 12, remember, chapter 12 is an exposition of command 1, which is no other gods. So how are you going to show the world that there's no other gods? You're going to destroy all other forms of worship. Oh, Joyce. Over, yes. Well, so now it's the opposite. Okay, I've told you twice already, you got to destroy these things. How are you going to be righteous? You don't put them back up. You don't tear them down, then put them back up, okay? But think about it, too. When Israel goes into the land, this generation, again, is one of the best generations that Israel has that's going to go conquer the land because they are obedient, and they do destroy. It doesn't mean they don't make mistakes, right? But they are obedient. As long as Joshua and the elders are alive, they're a good generation. Okay, but remember, Deuteronomy is not just for this generation either. It's for future generations. So it's like saying, hey, okay, maybe your dad and granddad and great-granddad, whatever, tore all this stuff down. If you're going to remain righteous, you cannot turn back to idolatry, right? You have to only have one God always, okay? No idolatry ever, okay? Which... it was a huge temptation because all the surrounding nations, this is what they did. And so Israel was to stand out in such stark contrast to the culture, right, to represent God. And that's hard. I mean, we even know how hard it can be in our daily lives to stand out in stark contrast to the culture. Okay. But yes, God has to say it over and over and over again. Okay. Yeah.
This says, you shall not plant for yourself an Asherah of any kind of tree beside the altar of Yahweh your God.
Yes.
It makes it sound like it was a tree. Does that?
It says you shall, plant for yourself an Asherah of any kind of tree. Okay. So we're not 100% sure if it was a pole or if it was a kind of tree. I mean, they had sacred trees. They worshipped all kinds of things.
Back
so.
In 12 where you read that it said to cut it down.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yes, could be a pole or
you
know, a tree.
Yep. Yep. Okay. Also, if you go back to chapter 4, right, God talks about idolatry a lot because this was going to be a huge problem. This is what takes Israel down, is idolatry, okay? This is why they are sent into exile, because they abandon Yahweh and become like all the nations and have their idols, okay? So God had to say it over and over and over again because he knows this is what's coming. Chapter 4, verse 25, right? And remember, we talked about this. God is saying, you know, don't have any idols. Don't do any of these things. And then verse 25, when this is going to happen, when you become the father of children and children's children and have remained long in the land and act corruptly and make an idol in the form of anything and do that which is evil in the sight of the Lord your God so as to provoke him to anger, right? So God knows it's coming, and God tells Israel that it's coming. I command you, don't do these things. But it's going to happen. Generations from now, you are going to forsake me, and you are going to act corruptly. Idolatry is a corruption. It takes something which is good, which is man's inherent nature that needs to worship something, worship God, right? And it twists it. It takes that worship, and instead of pointing it towards Yahweh, it points it to whatever else, a tree, right? Another god, the heavens, the stars, the sun, the moon, whatever it is, animals, okay? It is a corruption, okay? Israel was to worship God only and in the one way he commanded. We talked about this. They don't get to worship God any willy-nilly way they like, right? Because chapter 12, right? You are to worship where? Where God chooses, at the temple, right? The one place. You don't get to offer sacrifices on every hilltop that you want to. No, you have to do it God's way, because when you do that, you are proclaiming to the nations, our God is very different than all your gods, right? There's one God, and there's one way to worship him, okay? So righteousness is a society that reflects and is brought into conformity with God's very character. Okay, so if the society is to be righteous as a whole, it has to reflect God's character and has to be in line with God's character. Okay, which Asherah trees or poles or whatever, pillars. Verse 22, you shall not set up for yourself a sacred pillar, which the Lord your God hates, right? Conformity with God's character means no idolatry. Because idolatry inherently corrupts and twists what is right and true. Okay, so first step in having a righteous society, you cannot have any idolatry. It cannot exist. Because God hates it, right? The Lord your God hates idolatry. Okay? Chapter 17, verse 1. Totally random switch of topics, unless you understand we're all talking about righteousness. You shall not sacrifice to the Lord your God an ox or sheep which has a blemish or any defect, for that is a detestable thing to the Lord your God, right? Israel was not to sacrifice defective animals. They were only to offer the best to God. Again, they don't get to worship any willy-nilly way they want. They have to worship the way God commands them to, okay? And Israel is condemned for this later on. Can someone read for me Malachi 1, 6 through 8? Malachi 1, 6 through 8.
How have we defiled you? In that you say, the table of the Lord is to be despised. But when you present the blind for a sacrifice, is it not evil? And when you present the lame and sick, is it not evil? Why not offer it to your comfort? Would he be pleased with you, or would he receive you kindly, says the Lord of hosts?
Okay, so by this point, Israel, they're offering their leftovers to God. So they're still maintaining a form of worship, right? And the priests are saying, how have we despised you, God? We're offering you the sacrifices. We're doing the morning and evening sacrifices. People are bringing their sacrifices. God, what's your problem? God's saying, seriously, right? They're not obeying the command. And the problem isn't necessarily the blind animal, right? The problem is their heart, okay? Because they don't have a heart that loves God. And so they're trying to get away, you know, say, hey, look, outwardly, God, we're obeying, but not really, okay? Because we're just going to give you our leftovers, because the firstborn or the strong, healthy one, I want to keep that one to breed, you know, so that I can get richer. But, oh, God, you can have this lame one or this blind one, okay? So judges on a horizontal level were to establish the mechanism for the priest to operate. So if somebody brings a lame-blind animal, right, the judges can be the ones to be like, no, this is what the law says. You can't do that, right? And they're going to be the ones that can establish righteousness or even teach the people so that they know, right? No, God says you can't bring those type of animals. You have to bring the right type of animal in order to sacrifice, right? And then that's going to make the priest's job a whole lot easier, right? Assuming the priests are righteous themselves, which that was the problem in Malachi. Even the priests were not righteous, right? They were accepting these sacrifices, no problem. And they're saying, God, what's your problem? Why are you having a problem with what we're doing? Okay. So the priests obviously are going to operate best in a society that is righteous. And it is the job of the king and the judges to create a society that is righteous. Okay. All right, then we have verses, chapter 17, verses 2 through 7. What does this remind you of? You should read this and say, hey, I've read this before. Verses 2 through 7. It's in Deuteronomy. No, we just had a whole chapter. I know, it's hard. Yes, Deuteronomy 13. Deuteronomy 13 relates to command 2, right? Which command 5, which is where we are now, parallels commands 1 and 2. If you remember, Deuteronomy 13 was 3 instances, basically all the same. I mean, 3 different situations, but basically all the same events, right? Where what do you do if someone tempts you to idolatry, tempts you to go search out other gods, right? The first one is if you had a religious leader, a prophet, a dreamer, tell you go to search other gods. The second was what if your best friend, your wife, your brother, your child, somebody very intimate, close to you tells you to go search out after other gods. Then what do you do if an entire city goes apostate and goes after other gods, right? And in all 3 of them, what were you supposed to do? Stone them, right? And with the city, you were to kill everybody and burn the city to the ground and burn all the stuff up. You weren't to take anything from it, and the city was never to be rebuilt again. Okay, so absolute destruction for anyone who goes after idolatry. So here, it's basically the same thing. It's like chapter 13 repeat, just summarized a little bit. Okay, so human authority, again, is to reflect God's authority. So the judges, again, are to establish righteousness in Israel. They are the human authority. Okay, if they do this, it would take us back to Eden, right? If the whole society is righteous, if that's the goal, if the whole society is righteous, right, we're back in the Garden of Eden, right, with Adam and Eve before the fall. So we know that's not going to happen this side of the millennium, but, or really this side of eternity, because even after the millennium, you get rebellion, okay? But that is the goal of Israel, to get back to creation, to get back to Eden. Okay? Verse 2 through 3, if there is found in your midst in any of your towns which the Lord your God is giving you, a man or a woman who does what is evil in the sight of the Lord your God by transgressing his covenant and has gone and served other gods, worship them, or the sun or the moon or any of the heavenly hosts which I have not commanded. Okay? So worshiping anything else in creation is an abandonment of Yahweh and breaks the covenant. This is the most grievous sin. You cannot get worse than this. When you abandon the one true God and say, I'm going to take my worship elsewhere, there is no greater offense to God. Because he and he alone is creator God, and he alone is worthy of worship. So when we take our worship and put it anywhere else, that is the worst thing we could do. Verse 4, and if it is told you, so a direct report, and you have heard of it, if you heard of it through rumor, like, oh, maybe this has happened, right? What are you supposed to do? You shall inquire thoroughly, okay? You got to do your homework. You got to make sure that the accusation is true, that the rumor is true, whichever, okay? Because the sin is so grievous and the punishment is so severe, you can't just be going and stoning people all over the place, right? You got to make sure that you're right. Right? Because if you have righteous judgment, right, you're doing what's right, and stoning someone who is not guilty of idolatry is not righteous. It's not justice. Okay. And the punishment is stoning in verse 5. Then you shall bring out the man or the woman who has done this evil deed, assuming your thorough inquiry results in a guilty verdict, right? This man or woman, you shall stone them to death. Okay. Verse 6 and 7, on the evidence of two witnesses or three witnesses, he who is to die shall be put to death. He shall not be put to death on the evidence of one witness. The hand of the witness shall be the first against him to put him to death. Okay? So two witnesses required. This cannot be a my word versus your word case, right? I say you're worshiping other gods and you say you're not. Okay? So there have to be at least two witnesses. And the witnesses have a great responsibility. Because if you're going to accuse someone of this, you have to be willing to also throw the first stone to carry out the judgment. Okay, now the rest of the community is going to join in, right? But the witnesses have to be the ones that first do it. And if you remember, in Deuteronomy 13, when it says, if your wife or your best friend or your son or your daughter tempts you to worship other gods, you have to be the one to throw the first stone. Your love of God has to be so great that you are willing to put to death those closest to you if they have abandoned God. Okay, and so it's the same idea here. If you're going to be a witness against this person saying they have created this, you know, they have committed this grievous sin, you also have to be willing to carry out the judgment. Okay, and this would hopefully negate some of the possible, you know, lying against someone or false accusations. Okay. And the purpose, Israel is to be righteous, right? Why do they do this? So you shall purge the evil from your midst. Okay. They have to get rid of the evil among them if they are going to be truly righteous. All right, then verses 8 through 13. This is telling the judges what to do if they come across a case that is too difficult. Okay, verse 8. If any case is too difficult for you to decide between one kind of homicide or another, one kind of lawsuit or another, between one kind of assault or another, it doesn't really matter. Okay, the point is, if you come across a situation where you're not sure how the law applies, or you don't know who's really lying or who's really telling the truth, and you've done your homework and you've done your best and you can't figure it out and you don't know what to do, local judge in your small little town, okay, what do you do? Are you without recourse? You know, do you just have to make a best decision and cross your fingers and hope it's the right one? No, you have a higher court you can appeal to. Okay? And this will truly establish righteousness, because you don't want a judge just crossing his fingers and hoping he's making the right decision, right? You want to make sure it is a right decision. So if it is too complicated of a case for whatever reason, right, what do you do? End of verse 8, then you shall arise and go up to the place which the Lord your God chooses. Well, no. I mean, you can, yes, but you actually physically get up and travel to Jerusalem. Okay, which it doesn't say Jerusalem, it says the place that God chooses, but that we know later on is going to be Jerusalem. Okay, why? Why do they have to go to Jerusalem? That's where God is. That's where the temple is, or the tabernacle. That's where he reigns from. Now, obviously, God is everywhere, right? But remember, what was Jerusalem to proclaim to the world? Yes, but not like that. What was the point of Jerusalem? We did our whole Jerusalem theology. What does Jerusalem proclaim to the world? That there's only one God. Chapter 12. Chapter 12 is an exposition of command one. There is one God. Okay? And so it's not that God can't operate anywhere else. The point of Jerusalem, though, is to be an example to the world. There is one God, and this is where he dwells, in Jerusalem, right? And that's why we need a new one. Okay? And that's why rebuilding Jerusalem was so important in Ezra and Nehemiah, okay, the temple and the walls of Jerusalem, because Jerusalem proclaims to the world there is one God. So even after the exile, oh, guess what world, there's still only one God. Yeah, Israel messed up and God punished them, but there's still only one, okay? And that's why Jesus is going to reign from Jerusalem, Okay, because it says something to the world. All right, so you go to Jerusalem because that's where God is. That's where he reigns. And righteousness always points back to Yahweh. Okay? They bring it. They bring the judges who can't figure out a case, bring it before Yahweh. Verse 9. So you shall come to the Levitical priest. Remember, what's the job of the priest? He can go up to God. He can ask God. Right? He can intercede for you. So you go to the priest or the judge, or probably both, who's in Jerusalem. Right? The judge in Jerusalem presumably is more knowledgeable of the law, knows more intricacies of the law, and so he might be able to better interpret the law to your case. And if it's still too complicated, the priests, they can go directly to Yahweh and they can ask and they can get a decision from God himself. Okay, so if it's too complicated, you bring it to Jerusalem, and in essence, you let God decide. Okay, that's the whole point. Verse 9, you shall come to the Levitical priest or the judge who is in the office those days, and you shall inquire of them, and they will declare to you the verdict in the case. So they're going to hear all the details of the case. If they can't decide it according to the law either, right? Then they're going to take it before God, and then they're going to come back and they're going to have a decision for you. Then verse 10, you shall do according to the terms of the verdict, right? Which they declare to you from the place which the Lord chooses. You shall be careful to observe according to all that they teach you, right? Maybe you're just not versed in that section of law. You haven't dealt with something. So maybe the judge can teach you lesser judge, you know, more about the law, and you can learn about it, right? That this is what God wants. Or maybe it's the very verdict of God himself, right? Received from the priests, right? Oh, so you better obey it. You can't say, oh, Jerusalem, good decision. Okay, now I'm just going to go my way and do my own thing. Okay, because if it is coming from the priests, if it is coming from Jerusalem, then it is coming from God himself. Okay. The judges and the people, right? Verse 11, according to the terms of the law which they teach you, and according to the verdict which they tell you, you shall do. You shall not turn aside from the word which they declare to you to the right or the left. The man who acts presumptuously by not listening to the priests who stands there to serve the Lord your God, nor to the judge, that man shall die. Okay, so if you don't like the verdict, you don't like the decision, right? You have to do it or you will sacrifice your life. Okay, because this is a judgment from God himself, and you cannot get a more righteous judgment than that. Okay, and so if you are going to rebel against that, then you deserve death. Thus you shall purge the evil from Israel, right? Because this is absolute rebellion against God and his word. If God directly gives you a judgment on your case, a verdict on your case, and you're like, yeah, no thanks, God. I'm going to go do my own thing, right? That is evil rebellion, and you have to die. And then verse 13, then all the people will hear and be afraid and will not act presumptuously again, right? The consequence is great. Okay.
It's interesting that all through this, they make a that there is an example made.
Yes.
For what is going to happen if you do such.
Yes.
Which is a whole other thing that we've got going. There's no example
anymore. No, we just let people go.
Everybody is, you know, we can't hurt people.
Right.
Because they have rights. And all through scripture, it's making an example of what people do that's wrong. And then it's supposed to be a lesson to everybody else.
Well, and it does, because it does prevent evil when you see, hey, if I do that, that is the consequence.
Right.
I don't want that consequence. It doesn't change hearts,
no.
But it does curb action. But yes.
It's just interesting that this Old Testament book is just showing us. You know, I never really thought about it before.
Yeah.
It's showing us where we've gone wrong.
Yep. Like, where have we gone right? Nowhere. Yeah.
I mean, like, we have Jethro and stuff.
And you're on it.
Dies.
Well, you're on it until you die naturally.
Which happened the other day.
Yeah.
But, interesting.
Yeah. Yep. Okay, now, this upholding this kind of righteousness, which king and judge is actually going to be able to do this? None.
Only a benevolent king, said Dr. Studd.
Yes. Right, well,
we don't have.
Right. And think, we have an entire book called Judges, right? Those judges are supposed to do this. Did they? Think of Samson. Right? Does Samson do this? Right, there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes, right? The whole point of judges is they're supposed to establish righteousness. Righteousness is God's standard, not doing what's right in your own eyes. That's your own standard of righteousness, which is no righteousness at all, okay? So this is God's standard for judges and kings. And Israel obviously fails. I mean, yep. Israel fails all the way around, right? Okay. In the class, Abner's class, I was listening to, one of the kids asked a question. You know, he's like, who does this apply to? He's like, the judges that Moses appointed, because if you remember, he got too busy, right? And they're saying appoint judges. He's like, or the judges in the book of Judges. And Abner was like, yes, like all of the above. And the kid's like, those guys were losers. And Abner's like, yup. But this is the standard that they were to live up to, okay? And clearly they failed. All right, any other questions, comments?
There's another thing to point that we need. They needed Christ, and we need
Christ. Right. Only Christ can do it perfectly. All right, can someone read for me verses 14 to 20?
When you enter the land which Yahweh your God gives you, and you possess it and live in it, and you say, I will set a king over me like all the nations who are around me, you shall surely set a king over you whom Yahweh your God chooses, one from among your brothers, and you shall set it as a king over yourselves. You may not put a foreigner over yourselves who is not your brother. Moreover, he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor shall he cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. Yahweh has said to you, you shall never again return that way. And he shall not multiply wives for himself, or else his heart will turn away, nor shall he greatly increase silver and gold for himself. Now it will be, when he sits on the throne for his kingdom, that he shall write for himself a copy of this law on a scroll in the presence of the Levitical priests. And it shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear Yahweh his God, to carefully observe all the words of this law and these statutes, that his heart may not be lifted up above his brothers, and that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right or to the left, so that he may prolong his days in his kingdom, and he and his sons in the midst of Israel.
Okay, so these are the requirements for king, which if you really study them, are quite countercultural. Okay, so verse 14, when you enter the land, okay, which they're about to do, which the Lord your God gives you, and you possess it and live in it. So this is assuming time has gone by, right? This is not going to be this generation. It's going to be, and we know, Judges spans, I believe, about 400 years, okay? So, if I remember correctly. So this is going to be a long time down the road, okay? And you possess and live in it, and you say, I will set a king over me like the nations who are around me. You shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses, one from among your countrymen. You shall set as king over yourself. You may not put a foreigner over yourselves who is not your countryman. Okay? So, Moses and God are assuming there is going to come a time that Israel is going to have a king. Okay? But if when they have a king, these are the requirements and characteristics that the king has to have or obey. Okay? So first, the first requirement, God chooses the king. Verse 15, you shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses. You don't get to choose willy-nilly, just like you don't get to choose where to worship. I mean, this is the same language of the place that God chooses, right? Jerusalem, the place where God chooses. Now this is going to be the king that God chooses. Okay, so you don't get to just have any king you want. You have to have the one the Lord your God chooses. Okay, so we're going to be flipping between this and 1 Samuel and all through the prophets. So can someone read for me 1 Samuel 8?
Samuel 8,
verses 4 through 9. We're going to see how Israel did.
We know already.
Yeah. 1 Samuel 8, 4 through 9.
Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. And they said to him, "Behold, you have grown old and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king for us to judge us like all the nations." But the thing was displeasing in the sight of Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to judge us." And Samuel prayed to the Lord. The Lord said to Samuel, "Listen to the voice of the people in regard to all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them, like all the deeds which they have done since the day I brought them up from Egypt, even to this day, in that they have forsaken me and served other gods. So they are doing that to you also. Now listen to their voice."
Yeah, that's fine. Okay, now listen. Okay, so God was to choose the king. Now, there's nothing inherently wrong with asking the people asking for a king, right? And they even kind of use the same words as Deuteronomy, right? Appoint a king, verse 5 of 1 Samuel 8. Now, appoint a king for us to judge us like all the nations. And in Deuteronomy says, "I will set a king over me like all the nations," right? So they're saying, "Hey, God, Samuel, you remember back in Deuteronomy you said we're going to have a king. We want one. We want one now." Okay, so set a king over us like all the nations. Now, anyone remember who Samuel is? What is his office? He's not high priest. He's not a priest.
He was a servant to another king, right?
No. He.
Oh, he's like the help.
Samuel is the final judge. We have the book of Judges, and then we have Samuel. Samuel is the last judge. That's why it says it's displeasing to Samuel, and God says, "For they have not rejected you, they have rejected me." They're saying, "Samuel, you're the judge. You're supposed to help establish righteousness," theoretically, if they were thinking this way, right? "But we don't want you. We want a king." Okay? And so then God says, "Samuel, don't worry. It's not that they're rejecting you as judge. They're rejecting me as their king." Okay? Because the king and the judge were to reflect God's righteousness. They were to try to establish God's righteousness. So if you reject a judge, right, who are you really rejecting? God. And in Deuteronomy, what did it just say? That if you reject a judge or the priest's final judgment on a verdict, what was supposed to happen to you? Yeah, you're supposed to die, because you're not just rejecting that judge's verdict. You're really rejecting God's verdict. You're rejecting God, okay?
If he's giving directions and about the characteristics and the requirements of the king, why is he upset that they're asking for a king?
Because they're asking for a king and they want one that they're going to choose. They're not going to allow God to bring about one in his own time. That this is going to be the problem. The problem is not that necessarily they want a king. It's that they're not willing to be patient and wait for God to bring about the king in his own time. They want this one now, and they're saying, "Samuel, you're judge. You're not good enough. We want a king. Go get us a king."
And this is before the whole Saul debacle.
Well, because this is the Saul debacle. Right, and here's the deal. What do we really know about Saul? What qualifies him as king? What is the first thing we're told about Saul? Yes, first, he's tall and he's handsome, right? 1 Samuel 9, verse 2. "He had a son whose name was Saul, a choice and handsome man. And there was not a more handsome person than he among the sons of Israel." I mean, this is like sexiest man alive, you know, whatever. Okay? "From his shoulders and up, he was taller than any of the people." So he is head and shoulders above everyone. Now, Abner pointed this out. I never thought about this before, but I thought this was hilarious. Okay, he is literally head and shoulders above everybody. Who chickens out when Goliath shows up? Saul. But, okay, so Goliath's huge, right? But who would be the more likely candidate to fight Saul?
The tall guy.
The tall guy. Like, at least the distance is less, right? But Saul just sits and does nothing. Right? And then so then here along comes David, just this punk little kid, right? And he's like, "I'll fight Goliath," right? But it's just, Abner pointed that out. I was like, I never thought about that before, that Saul is literally head and shoulders above everybody. else. Now, Goliath's going to be even taller than him, but at least it's a short, you know, a smaller difference. Anyway. Okay. So, Saul is the people's choice because he is tall and handsome. Okay? And so, God allows the people to have their king, the one they chose. Okay? Okay, then, can someone read for me 1 Samuel 16? Oh, we're not going to read all this. No, we're not even going to finish. Okay. Can you read for me just verse 1 and then verse 12 and 13? I assume we know this story, but 16, 1, and then 12 and 13.
Now the Lord said to Samuel, how long will you grieve over Saul, since I have rejected him from being king over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and go. I will send you to Jesse the Bethlehemite.
Yep.
For I have selected a king for myself among his sons.
And then 12 and 13.
So he sent and brought him in. Now he was ruddy with beautiful eyes and handsome appearance. And the Lord said, arise, anoint him, for this is he. Then Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the midst of his brothers. And the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon David that from that day forward. And Samuel arose and went to Ramah.
Okay, so this is God's choice. Saul is what the people chose. David is who God chose, right? And God tells Samuel, go, I've picked one of Jesse's sons, right? And then the story goes in, the first one comes in, and Samuel's like, oh, surely this is it. And no. And he goes until David's the youngest, right? But it's David is the one that God has chosen. And Saul, poor Saul, right? He basically functions as a foil to David. So he's just a contrast with David, right? Saul is everything a king shouldn't be, and David is the one that God chose. Okay? So, first requirement, God has to choose. Okay? So Israel's first king, Saul, failure because the people chose it. So they broke the first requirement of the kings. Back to Deuteronomy 17, second half of verse 15. Okay? So first, it has to be the one the Lord your God chooses. Second, it has to be from among your countrymen. You shall set as king over yourselves. You may not put a foreigner over yourselves who is not your countryman, okay? So it has to be one of your brothers. Part of the reason for this is the king has to represent the people, right? We call this corporate solidarity, right? Where the one has to represent the many, right? And when the people fail, the king's going to fail. When the people succeed, the king's going to succeed, okay? And the king is going to suffer the punishment for the people, because this is how this whole system works, okay? So the importance of it being one of your countrymen is that he has to be a representative of the people before God, okay? And then we said, who else up here is going to be a countryman?
The prophet,
because it's going to be the same thing for prophets, right? They're going to have corporate solidarity too. Even though they're receiving word from the Lord, right? And they have a right relationship with the Lord. When the people suffer for their sins, who else suffers? The prophets. Well, God is sad, yes, but the prophets also suffer. Okay? Okay, so those are the two requirements. God chooses, and it has to be a countryman or a brother, okay? An Israelite. Those are the two requirements for king. Then, verse 16 and 17. There are three things that the kings are not allowed to multiply. And I don't know if you guys have heard this before. It's a little goofy, okay? But it's the three G's they're not allowed to multiply. Girls, gold, and giddy up for horses, okay? Because we had to have another G, okay? So girls, gold, and giddy up, you're not allowed to multiply. Okay, the first one is actually the giddy up, the horses. Okay, so in verse 16, moreover, the king, he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor shall cause his people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. Since the Lord has said to you, you shall never again return that way. Okay, so you're not allowed to gather a ton of horses. Why would a king want to get a lot of horses? Military. Yeah, chariots were the most advanced, you know, war weapon of the time. So the king was not to build up his military, basically, with horses. Okay, the king was to rely on God to win the battles for him. He was not to rely on his own power and strength. Israel specifically here is forbidden to contract with Egypt for horses. Okay? Think about this. God decimated Egypt's horses and chariots, right? They all come chasing after Israel with all their chariots, and God just drowns them all. Right? So God decimated Egypt and their horses. Why would you be going and asking Egypt for help instead of just asking God for help? Like, who's stronger here? Right? God, obviously. The problem with man is it's a lot easier to trust in something you can see and something tangible, right? Can someone read for me Ezekiel 17, verses 11 through 15? Ezekiel? This is almost at the final Well, it's in the middle of the Babylonian exile, I think, but Ezekiel 17, 11 to 15. There's still kind of a puppet government in Jerusalem.
Moreover, the word of the Lord came to me, saying, say not to the rebellious house, do you not know what these things mean? Say, behold, the king of Babylon came to Jerusalem, took its king and princes, and brought them to him in Babylon. He took one of the royal family and made a covenant with him, putting him under oath. He also took away the mighty land, that the kingdom might be in subjection, not exalting itself, but keeping his covenant that it might continue. But he rebelled against him by sending his envoys to Egypt, that they might give him horses and many troops. Will he succeed? Will he who does such things escape? Can he indeed break the covenant and escape?
Okay, so this is Zedekiah. This is, there were a couple Babylonian Babylon taking people out of Judah. Okay, and so first they take the mighty and they leave a puppet government in Jerusalem. And it's King Zedekiah, who is of the line of David. Okay, and Zedekiah is supposed to obey the Babylonian king. But what does Zedekiah do? Verse 15. What does he do specifically? What did God say the king is not allowed to do? Okay, so the thing is, when you read Samuel's, Kings, Chronicles, the prophets, now, it's saying he rebelled and did these things, but Ezekiel doesn't specifically point out this very action was in defiance of God's law for kings, right? The prophets just assume, you already know Deuteronomy. The prophets assume that when you read this, alarm bells go off in your head and you say, ooh, the kings weren't supposed to multiply horses, number one. And two, God like especially forbid them from going to Egypt to get their horses.
Okay. Solomon did for sure.
Yes.
Did David
get horses from Egypt?
I'm not sure if David,
I'm not sure. So in the rest of the Old Testament, it's not going to specifically point out and say, hey, ding, 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 this was wrong, trouble is coming. You're just supposed to know the law and see it and be like, trouble's coming. Solomon, right? Girls, gold, and giddy up. What did Solomon do? All of them, right? And what happened? Yes, and what happened after he died? Yeah. The kingdom split. That's it. Israel as a whole is done, right? Why? Because the king disobeyed God's law. Okay, now in Kings, it's not necessarily going to draw that parallel, right? That the kingdom falls apart because Solomon disobeys. But if you know the law, right, as you're reading the story of Solomon, you're going, hey, Solomon, watch out, dude. you're just heading down the road to trouble because God said, don't multiply horses, don't multiply girls, don't multiply gold.
But yet he was a wise king.
Yes, he was. Right, but he also wrote Ecclesiastes, right? And so he realizes at the end of his life, everything I've done is meaningless, meaningless. It's all right in the end of Ecclesiastes. The only thing that we do is this, right? We cling to the word of the Lord. I can't remember the exact verse, right? But I mean, so Solomon, I mean, because he wrote most of Proverbs, and Ecclesiastes and Song of Songs, right? I mean, so he wrote scripture, but he did not live his life in accordance with the law of God. Okay, and that's going to be a problem.
Well, and we think how easy it is to, we know these things and we know the right thing to do. Like, I just think in parenting, I know it is better for me to not yell and scream at my children than it is
right.
to just discipline them and train them up in a right and honorable way.
Doesn't mean you always choose that.
Doesn't mean I always choose that because I am faulty.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay. So the second thing. In verse 17, Deuteronomy 17:17, he shall not multiply wives for himself. Why would a king want to multiply wives? Okay, more children, but mostly political alliances, right? How did you make relations with your neighboring countries? They would give you a wife, you would give them a daughter, you know, something like this, right? And now your countries are aligned through marriage, okay? So, and a lot of Solomon's wives, where did they come from? Foreign countries, political alliances. It makes sense, doesn't it? Like, this is a worldly wise move to make. It makes logical sense to do that, right? Because now we're not going to go to war because we're aligned through marriage. I mean, right? Europe did this all the time through their kings, right? That's how they brought peace between nations, as they would intermarry, okay? But God's saying no. And why? He says specifically why you should not multiply wives. Verse 17. Why do you not multiply wives?
Because they bring
idols. Well, specifically, what does it say? Or else? His heart will turn away. It's always the heart. God is concerned about your heart. Okay, Deuteronomy 6:5, love the Lord your God with all your heart. Okay, you don't get all these foreign wives. You don't make all these political alliances because they're foreign and they'll bring their gods with them and they're going to turn your heart away from Yahweh, right? You are the king. You are supposed to establish righteousness. What was the first thing in the righteousness? Don't build an Asherah pole. You bring in a foreign wife, what's the first thing she's going to want to do?
Build a pole.
Build an Asherah pole, right? Or tree, whatever, you know, to worship her God her way. And now you're in a sticky situation because you don't want to make her mad because she might go running to daddy, you know, and saying, hey, you married me off and now he's not going to allow me to worship my gods, you know? So this is a problem. God knows, don't marry foreign women. They will turn your heart. Okay, and, oh man, okay, we're going to have to be done soon. But 1 Samuel 13, I'll read it. 1 Samuel 13, verse 14 says, this is Samuel talking to Saul. This is Samuel talking to Saul, and he says, but now your kingdom shall not endure, right? Saul has just blown it. The Lord has sought out for himself a man after his own heart. And the Lord has appointed him as ruler over his people because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you. Okay, David is called a man after God's own heart because that is what God is always worried about, is the heart of man. Okay, and that comes all the way back from Deuteronomy, right? So when we read something like that in Samuel, we need to think Deuteronomy. Okay, we'll cover gold, and then we'll be done for today. Okay, so the third thing, you're not allowed to multiply, right? End of verse 17, nor shall he greatly increase silver and gold for himself. Okay, so gold is a representation of power and wealth. Okay, a true king is not interested in getting rich for himself, right? He has to be interested in obeying and loving God and establishing righteousness in his nation. Now think about it. If you're a foreign king reading this, you're like, man, what an emaciated king. He can't have military power. He can't have political alliances. And he can't have any economic power. Like, what kind of king is this? This is not a king, right?
But this, he's got God on his side.
Well, and that's the point. The point is Yahweh is Israel's true king, okay? And the king, his job is not to be this mighty ruler among the nations, right? His job is to establish righteousness among Israel. And then God will ensure that he has military might. Because who's going to fight the battles?
God.
The king's horses? No, God, right? Jonathan, I think Jonathan and his, like, shield bearer, two people, like, wipe out an entire camp of Philistines, right? I mean, with God, you don't even need the people. And, oh, I can't remember the story where it's like Jerusalem's under siege and they just wake up in the morning and the whole army's dead, right? I can't remember. Anyways, I wish my Bible memory was better, okay? But if God's fighting for you, you don't even need one horse, okay? Political alliances. God will let you conquer the nations that he wants you to conquer because he'll do it, and he will bring peace if he wants you to have peace because he's going to do it, right? And wealth, God has said, if you obey, I will send the rain, right? And I will do these things, and you would naturally be well taken care of. You don't have to be super duper wealthy, right? But God's going to take care of you if you do things God's way. But God's way is totally countercultural to how kings or any ruler of any nation, think even our government, operates, right? God's taking away their military, God's taking away their political alliances, and God's taking away your wealth and saying, this is what the kings are supposed to be, okay? They are to rely on God for all, okay? When the kings disobey, you know doom is coming. For like Solomon, we said, he disobeys all three, right? And yes, God is gracious and doesn't bring judgment during his lifetime, but judgment falls immediately afterwards because his son was an idiot, right? He had wise counselors, his daddy's counselors. He had wise counselors, and he chose to listen to his foolish friends instead of his daddy's wise counselors, and the nation split. Okay, let's read one last passage and then we're done. Can someone read for me Isaiah 2, 7 to 9? And hopefully through this, when you read passages like this, you have to be thinking Deuteronomy because it's not going to expressly say it. Isaiah 2, 7 to 9. Or just 7 and 8. Sorry, I don't know why I put 9. 7 and 8.
And there is no end of to their treasures. Their land was also filled with horses, and there is no end to their chariots. Their land was also filled with idols, and they worshiped the work of their hands, and or that which their fingers had made.
Okay, so they have gold, multiplied gold. They have multiplied horses, and now they're filled with idols. Why? Because they have a bunch of foreign women bringing them in. Okay, so here in Isaiah 2, Israel has done what? All three. Okay, and it's not going to say this is the law of the kings. Oh, remember back in Deuteronomy. You have to know Deuteronomy 17 so well that you make that connection yourself. You can't multiply gold, you can't multiply girls, and you can't multiply the giddy up, the horses.